This is Second Look, a look back at some of the stories and conversations from our newsroom this week. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director. Coming up later in the half hour, the next installment of our Clean Virginia series and a patriotic themed story from last fall from WMRA's Andrew Jenner. But first, there's a new WMRA reporter in the newsroom. Her name is Amy Leffler, and she visited an orchard near Charlottesville that may represent the hot new thing in Virginia agriculture, truffles.
The scientific name for black truffles, tuber melanosporum, may not sound very sexy, but truffles are one of the most coveted items of gastronomes and chefs for their sensual fragrance and je ne sais quoi that they impart to foods flavored with them. Truffles are not technically mushrooms. They are a fungus that grows below ground in a symbiotic relationship with trees in their roots, feeding off of the sugars of the root plant while the tree roots feed themselves through the fungus. Pat and John Martin own and operate a truffle orchard outside of Charlottesville on a property they have dubbed Les Clos de la Rabasse, or the cul-de-sac of the truffle. That's Wellington you hear, the Martin's 6-year-old truffle hunting yellow lab, putting his sniffer to work. The Martins want to add Virginia to the roster of states in the Mid-Atlantic where truffles are cultivated. Right now, North Carolina and Tennessee are the only two states that are currently producing viable truffle crops. The Martins started their orchard of beech trees in the mid-aughts and are due for a harvest any time now, making Les Clos de la Rabasse ground zero for winter black Perigord truffle production in the state.
We would say never invest your life savings or your retirement or any of it into this because it is high risk. But it is an adventure. And we talk about this from time to time. Just how did we get into this?
Agriculture is the Commonwealth's number one industry, and according to the governor's office, generated more than $3.35 billion in exports last year. And a lucrative crop such as truffles could be an economic boon for farmers willing to take the risk of planting an orchard. The crop could also attract younger farmers who could reinvigorate the rapidly aging farming population in the Commonwealth and across the United States. Cultivating truffles is not complicated, but it is risky. Truffles that are cultivated get their start from inoculated seedlings that are planted in soil that drains well. With a little luck from Mother Nature, truffles start to develop and can be cultivated within 5 years. A telltale brulé or burnt area develops around the roots of the trees, indicating truffle activity is present. Even if Virginia might be a few seasons away from producing the black diamonds of the kitchen, the enthusiasm is there on the part of chefs for a local product that can fetch up to $800 per pound and is highly perishable. Executive chef Jared Adams of Charlottesville's Clifton Inn has worked in the hospitality industry for more than 16 years and would welcome the opportunity to incorporate a locally grown truffle into his gastronomic offerings.
That would be a really amazing thing to have a local truffle orchard nearby, primarily for freshness reasons. Everything we buy now is either from Oregon or imported from overseas. We're looking at how North Carolina and Tennessee have grown with their truffle orchards. I think there's definitely a viable market for chefs who especially foster the philosophy of buying local, buying fresh, would relish the opportunity to have their hands on the product and smell it and then be able to serve that to their guests.
Back at Les Clos de la Rabasse, the Martins reflect on how far they've come since their first planting.
Now, of course, the real satisfaction will be the first time we pull a truffle out of the ground. Then we'll know it was all worth it. Because it does take a lot of time, and patience is important and not my strong suit. I guess it's like starting any new endeavor, and probably something like this that is largely entrepreneurial. It always takes more time and more money than you think it's going to. But when you get it, when you get what you're after, when you achieve the goal, and we can see it coming, it's coming. So it's very satisfying.
For WMRA News, I'm Amy Leffler.
In 1979, researchers at the University of Virginia launched the Shenandoah Watershed Study. Among other things, the study tracked the impact of the Clean Air Act on watersheds and wildlife, such as trout, across much of western and central Virginia. In part 6 of WMRA's Clean Virginia series, Kara Lofton reports.
In the 1950s and 1960s, cheap energy came mostly from coal-fired power plants. The plants effectively produced lots of energy at low financial cost to citizens, but it had other costs to the public in the form of the unregulated release of heavy metals and acidic pollutants into the atmosphere. So in 1963, in response to growing national concern about air pollution, Congress passed the Clean Air Act, which authorized research into techniques for monitoring and controlling air pollution. It was the first attempt at air quality regulation. But it wasn't enough. Soon, even the rain became toxic to the very ecosystems it was supposed to sustain. Several amendments to the original act have been passed since. Jim Galloway is a professor of environmental studies at the University of Virginia.
Rain's acidic due to human action because of sulfuric acid and nitric acid. Both of these are primarily from coal-fired power plants, to some degree natural gas-fired power plants.
The problem with acid rain is that ecosystems, in particular watersheds, have a very delicate balance of parts, which includes maintaining a balanced chemical pH. When acid rain falls into these watersheds, it very quickly disrupts every system in the watershed, from trout to algae to nutrients. So in 1979, Galloway and a few other young faculty from the University of Virginia pioneered the Shenandoah Watershed Study in order to track how watersheds respond to both natural and human-originated environmental changes. As luck would have it, that was just 2 years after a major amendment to the Clean Air Act that established national emission standards for hazardous air pollutants, including those that contribute to acid rain.
We were extremely fortunate, although we didn't know it at the time, that when we started in 1979, that over the course of the study, the emissions of sulfur dioxide to the atmosphere and nitrogen oxides, which contribute to sulfuric acid and nitric acid, greatly decreased due to the Clean Air Act and its amendments. And so over the course of time, we've seen a steady decrease in the acidity of precipitation and the amount of sulfuric and nitric acids in it.
The decrease is due, in part, to new technology that regulates the amount and kind of pollution that is allowed to enter the atmosphere. The most advanced of the technology can remove up to 98% of sulfur dioxide and other acidic gas emissions that cause acid rain. This is particularly important in Virginia because the type of soil here actually absorbs sulfur and releases it in the same slow way that a poorly sealed sink will eventually drain itself.
It takes a very long time for chemical recovery to occur because the soils store the acid sulfate in soil structure and it's only released slowly over time.
And chemical recovery must occur before biological recovery can start, he said. Back in the late 1970s, when they first started the study, Galloway's team began to track remote streams in Shenandoah National Park with traditionally lively populations of brook trout. Galloway said brook trout are important because they're very sensitive to changes in their natural environment.
People like trout as living species. People like trout to eat, too. But people like trout and they like to catch trout and release them or catch trout and eat them. But there's a public engagement with the science we're doing by this focus on trout. And so what we found is that as streams acidify, the biological populations become less diverse. Fewer fish, fewer plants, fewer microorganisms. In some cases, the acidity of the stream has increased so much that there are no fish in the streams.
But that may soon change.
In the last 10 to 15 years, as the acidity of precipitation has decreased due to the decreased emissions of sulfur dioxide and nitrogen oxides, we have seen a lessening of the acidity in the streams itself.
He said while the trout populations are still lower than they should be, models suggest that as the streams continue to become less acidic over the next couple decades, the fish should come back. As they do, the ecosystem should stabilize, the soil will let go of the sulfur, and it's possible that the term acid rain will just become part of history. In the end, the efficacy of the law can be seen in places, such as Galloway's Virginia Mountain Streams, where equilibrium has returned and the brook trout, that sensitive canary in the coal mine type creature, can recover and even thrive. For WMRA News, I'm Kara Lofton.
Yesterday, of course, was Independence Day, so It seems fitting to revisit an excellent story from last September when, in Stanton, the number of American citizens increased by 80. One man from Iraq was one of those new citizens, swearing the oath of allegiance to the United States. WMRA's Andrew Jenner was there. It was part five of our series last fall on Becoming American.
A large crowd has turned out on this gorgeous September morning under a large pavilion at the Frontier Culture Museum in Stanton. As the Stonewall Brigade band toots away, a few hundred school kids get swept up in the excitement, madly waving little flags as they chatter. An ROTC honor guard presents the colors, someone sings the national anthem, and then a U.S. Marshal officially opens this special and particularly fun session of Federal District Court, a naturalization ceremony for 80 new American citizens. Seated in the very front is a man named Aziz Aziz, who lived nearly all his life in Iraq.
I born in Baghdad. I spent my life in Baghdad.
Aziz was an engineer who spent his career trying to improve farm mechanization in his country. Though looking back, it seems all for naught.
With the chaos, with the corruption, I couldn't develop this project in a good way.
Iraq, he says, could be fabulously wealthy, but over the course of his lifetime, everything has been wasted, lost, including his sense of civic pride.
Citizenship means a good relationship between the citizen and the ruler, and this was lost. There is no secure life, there is no rights, there is no freedom. My country, Iraq, is the worst country in the world.
And so he and his family left Iraq in 2006, eventually settling in the United States in 2009. Gaining citizenship here in their adopted country is a major step toward making it their permanent home. U.S. Magistrate Judge James Welsh, who presided over the ceremony, describes naturalization as one of this country's most distinctive and invigorating characteristics.
It's what makes America truly a unique place, that we have people from all over the world that have come here, cast their lot with us to become citizens and raise their children as part of this country.
Because the vast majority of Americans can trace their roots abroad within the past few centuries, the Frontier Culture Museum is a fitting location for all of this, says Executive Director John Avoli.
And the museum is about immigrants, the original immigrants from Scotland and Ireland, England and Germany, and of course the enslaved African that was here. And these people came together somehow and culturalized, intermarried, intermingled, and they began to build America as we know it today.
Today in Stanton, 80 more immigrants have joined the cause.
It was a dream, and today it became fact that I and my family, we are citizens of the United States.
It becomes official when Judge Welsh leads him and the others in their oath of citizenship, by which they publicly renounce prior allegiances and promise to support and defend the Constitution. And then, that's that.
So help me God. Ladies and gentlemen, join me in a round of applause for our new
The band strikes up another tune, the mob of school children resumes its manic flag waving, the Elks Lodge spreads out pizza for lunch, and a merry pandemonium breaks out as 80 brand new Americans seek out their families and friends in the audience for pictures, for handshakes, and for hugs. For WMRA News, I'm Andrew Jenner.
And if you want to revisit that terrific series called Becoming American, you can do so at WMRA.org.
I think roller derby is a hopeful thing.
He earned enough money from selling plants that he paid off the mortgage on his house.
People always want to know, is that a lie or is that the truth?
I completely disassembled this Triumph TR6.
I wish I could have been a professional woman soccer player.
I'm Martha Woodruff, and this is The Spark, an exploration of interesting people doing interesting things. Sweetbriar College is temporarily saved and has a new president. Lawyer Philip Stone only recently stepped down after 16 years as president of Bridgewater, during which time he presided over the college's revitalization. And he retired, Philip Stone says, not because he was tired of being a college president, but because he believes that every institution benefits from periodic new blood. His post-Bridgewater plan was to resume practicing law, this time with his three children.
When Sweetbriar announced its closure, I just brashly said, it ought not close. And from there, the rest happened.
Whom did you say that to?
I said that to an acquaintance who had been a lawyer friend who also went into higher education. We were both commenting on the fact that we were shocked at the closure and thought it was such a wonderful school, beautiful campus, lovely facilities, and had such a great legacy and heritage that it was just beyond shocking to us that it closed. And I knew something about higher education, obviously, not only from my experience at Bridgewater, but as chairman of the accrediting agency, the Southern Association, for 3 years, and active in it longer than that, I had been involved in having to close schools that were not able to survive. Sweetbriar did not look like those schools. And so, not thinking that it would take me anywhere, I just simply said it ought to be saved. My friend mentioned me to the lawyers handling the Save Sweetbriar group. They looked at my credentials, some of them knew me by reputation, and called up and said, are you open to doing this? And again, being brash, I said, yes, I would. I said, I'm not interested in being part of the adversarial proceedings. I'm not going to be an expert witness. I just am saying very simply, if a board or the court ask me to serve, I will serve. And frankly, I have no contract. I have not ever discussed salary. I'm doing it because I'm a Virginian and I love Virginia and its institutions. I want to see this school survive. I was the kind of person who worked very, very hard for corporate and individual clients and all adults. All of a sudden, I was doing such things as greeting students when they arrived for enrollment in the fall, not only greeting them, but moving their furniture and appliances in. And I remember one student from Ohio said, I was moving her things up the steps. We didn't have air conditioning in that dorm, no elevator, so I went up three flights of steps. I think she had a refrigerator, a computer, a television, everything heavy in the world. And when I got up to the top, I finally finished, we were both kind of taking a breather, and I was leaning against the wall, and she said, and sir, what do you do here? When I said, I'm the president, she said, oh, my God. And I said, no, not that far, just the president.
You know, it strikes me that the law has absolutes. The law is the law. Will we go there?
There's some set principles, no question.
And I have spent my life around academic communities, and to go forward in an academic community involves consensus building. It involves dealing with turf. Was that a change for you?
It was. You know of my passion for Abraham Lincoln.
I certainly do.
And I consider him not just a historic figure that I like to study. I admire him as a role model, and I think about his ability to put his ego behind him. All of us in public environments have to have ego to have enough confidence to do certain things, and so I think sometimes we forget that it is simply a weapon to be able to use to help us, and we take ourselves so seriously that we start believing our own ego, what our ego tells us. Lincoln was such a humble man, and so I had the experience of having to bite my tongue sometimes to say, you know, like Lincoln, this is a time not to assert your power, your authority. For example, I was trying to get the faculty to agree in a what I called a transformational educational program in which students would document their development in multiple areas, including wellness, arts, and service learning, and all the dimensions of a holistic education, and treat it as a discipline, not just as a nice thing to do. That meant the faculty members had to do more work because they had to run this. It also meant they had to stretch themselves because they had to be role models. Someone teaching biology had to be talking to students about politics and the arts, and that meant they had to go to concerts. As we did that, one of the more senior faculty members said to me, are you telling me this is a condition of my employment? I do have tenure. And my response was, you know, I don't want to deal with my colleagues in terms of what you must do or what will happen if you don't do something. I'm telling you, this is really important. I beg you to help me. And he thought for a minute. He said, oh, heck, I'll do it. and he was a very faithful participant. I felt like when things like that happened, we got a lot more done. On the other hand, if something needed to be dealt with, misconduct, drugs, whatever, I was firm because I believe very strongly that the rest of the community has to be protected from certain types of behavior.
I bet you were a fabulous father.
I don't think my children would say that, but I hope I was. I hope I was and am. Well, they may be working with me just to keep me out of mischief.
They didn't succeed, did they?
When I start down the hall and sing out that I'm the senior partner, I'm in charge, I hear this giggling, and I think it means they don't take it that seriously. The new experience for me will be single-sex education because I've always been proud of the fact Bridgewater was the oldest coeducational college in Virginia, and I liked what it said not only about having men and women go to school together, but what it said about the right of women to participate fully in an educational institution. But Sweetbriar is still another opportunity for women in higher education, and so what I'm committed to is to maintain the patchwork of the variety of the institutions of higher learning so that we continue to have options. Some people flourish best in a single-sex environment. Others will flourish better in a co-ed environment. We need them both. And especially if you have that rich culture and heritage and reputation of Sweetbriar, we're just not going to lose that. One of the benefits of the turmoil that Sweetbriar has just experienced is that the alumni were so stirred up that they simply took charge of their college. And I wouldn't have given them a 2 cents for their chances of success when they started. Their energy, their commitment, their strength, their courage, I think represents such a model for women in leadership that one of the things we'll be saying to prospective students, are you good enough to be part of this group? This is the new Sweetbriar. These are real leaders. Most people don't know this. While they were raising pledges of $21 million in about 100 days, without any development office, without any staffing, without any directory information, while they were doing that, they also divided their very expert group up into groups to say, let's work on strategic planning, because if this college survives, we want to make sure we're ready to move. And they've got a wonderful strategic plan. I've seen it online. It's remarkable. Yeah. We'll need to negotiate it, and there will need to be more conversations. But it does not need 5 years of study. I mean, it's really pretty good.
You'll find some links, including one to the Sweetbriar College website, on the Spark page at WMRA.org.
Support for WMRA's News and Information Fund, which makes our coverage possible, comes from Bibb and Dolly Frazier, Eugene Stoltzfus, Janet Trentner, Rory and Jamie Kutaya, Joy Loving, Jim and Pam Huggins, an anonymous donor, and by a grant from a donor-advised fund of Harrisonburg and Rockingham County. And you, too, can contribute to in-depth coverage of issues, events, and people in our community. Find out more about the News and Information Fund at WMRA.org, where you'll also find all of our stories from the newsroom. Be sure to like us on Facebook, too, at WMRA Public Radio for a heads-up on our coverage. And you can follow me on Twitter at WMRABob. I'm Bob Levicki, WMRA's News Director and Morning Edition host. I'll see you in the morning.